Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we're seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We're seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which we are already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today's April 17, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here for the second part of the Alger Hiss series. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And before we really get into it, I just wanted to read a little thing I jotted down about Hiss here, my observations, and I'll begin. Alger Hiss was certainly no James Bond. He did not sabotage super weapons or assassinate elite officials. He wasn't any sort of Hollywood spy. However, in regards to the impact he had on the West, he was easily worth 1,000 James Bonds to the Soviet government. He was a textbook agent of ideological subversion, planting his bombs not in the factories or the city squares, but rather in the minds of the Westerners, in their ideology, and above all, in the institutions they created to protect themselves. He helped open the doors in the federal government to hundreds of his communist cronies. His importance to the advancement of the international communist conspiracy in the 1930s and 1940s cannot be understated. We all hear about Robert Hansen and Aldrich Ames on mainstream TV documentaries and how they were the most damaging and dangerous spies in American history because they turned over names of double agents and CIA assets in the Eastern Bloc to the Soviets. However, given what we now know about Alger Hiss, it must be considered that he was one of the most damaging spies to America ever to exist. He attacked the very foundation of the nation and helped open the gates to other subverters. And I think we pretty well established that last week, that he was...
Well, while he was subverting through policy as well as his influence in getting a lot of his cronies jobs in government.
That has a lot more of a lasting effect. If you take a list of, 10 or 20 names of double agents and blow the lid off those double agents and you compromise them and they get killed or they have to abandon their mission, that has an immediate impact. But if you help set policy for what the borders of post-war Europe are going to look like for the next 50 years, that has a historical impact.
Well, I'd like to read two paragraphs from Richard Nixon's book, Six Crises, and not because Richard... Well, he is an authority on his case. He was the... heavily involved in that House Un-American Activities Committee during the Hiss case. He was instrumental in exposing Hiss and the reason why he was indicted. And that was Richard Nixon's claim to fame and probably helped get him nominated for vice president a few years later. Well, under Eisenhower, right? To me, these two paragraphs are revealing not as much as to the impact of the Hiss case, but even more so to the naivety of people at the time and even Nixon's own naivety. I'm going to read these two paragraphs. The Hiss case aroused the nation for the first time to the existence and character of the communist conspiracy within the United States. It focused attention sharply on the conspiratorial aspects of the party. The Communist Party. The prevailing opinion in the country prior to the Hiss Chambers case was probably that the communists were nothing but a handful of noisy but relatively harmless left-wingers attempting to exercise their rights of free speech and political action. That's exactly what the Jews want us to believe, right? A substantial number of Americans believed the investigations of the House Committee on Un-American Activities were red-baiting for partisan purposes only. Well, you know something? If a substantial number of Americans believe that, it's because the media is also communist, right?
Absolutely.
Well, like Whitaker Chambers was the editor of Time magazine for how many years?
He was.
The unpopularity of the committee, whatever the reasons, caused many political leaders and opinion makers to dismiss without investigation anything the committee might discover and disclose about communism in the United States. Upon learning the communists and fellow travelers were holding important positions in government, they had already taken over the government. In education or in labor, many people simply responded, so what? All they are doing is exercising their legitimate freedom of speech and religion. Some went even further and charged that members of the committee, their allies, were really fascist agents bent on denying free expression to unpopular views.
Isn't that what they've
always the first problem with our country is that Jews are allowed to speak. The Hiss case, for the first time, forcibly demonstrated to the American people that domestic communism was a real and present danger to the security of the nation. As Herbert Hoover wrote me, meaning Nixon, after Hiss's conviction, quote, "At last the stream of treason that has existed in our government has been exposed in a fashion all may believe." Well, they're still denying it to this day. Chambers testified that his espionage ring was only one of several that had infiltrated the American government. He had yet to turn over to the committee and Justice Department hundreds of pages of confidential and secret documents from the State Department and other government agencies. And he testified that on at least 70 different occasions, the members of his ring had obtained a like number of documents, all of which he had transmitted to Soviet agents. And that just it shows the importance of the Hiss case, but it also shows, I believe, the naivety of the people, because by the time of Franklin Roosevelt's second or third term, I believe communists had fully taken over the government. The Jews had fully taken over the government, and Jews are communists. Communists are Jews, and even the capitalist Jews, we have seen Bernard Baruch and Jacob Schiff, they funded communism. They financed it. Communism is a puppet set up by capitalist Jews.
And you would think that that wouldn't occur if there was actually a controversy or a dispute between the capitalist Jews and the communist Jews, but it's only superficial.
It's absolutely superficial. They've gotten along just fine for ever since the inception of Marxism. Have they gotten? I mean, they've had their fights, but the fights that they've had, could simply just be boiled down to which gang is going to rule any given particular territory.
Their main argument is over the methods that should be used to fleece the Goyim.
Absolutely. You have the Mensheviks and you have the Bolsheviks. You have them in Tsarist Russia and you have them here today, where you have the progressives and the neocons. It's Mensheviks and Bolsheviks all over again. Well, we left off last week with Gerald Nye, right? I'd like to say we should probably cover Gerald Nye at greater length one day. Gerald Nye's historic investigation, I'm quoting from a Barnes Review article in February 1998. Gerald Nye's historic investigation into the munitions industry, which presented convincing evidence that international arms merchants in league with financial interests sought war for profit, propelled the phrase merchants of death into the national vocabulary. Then, as war clouds loomed in Europe, Nye fought for the cause of armed neutrality, winning the admiration of both the so-called right and left. He was a frequent speaker at rallies of the America First Committee and populist Father Charles Coughlin's National Union for Social Justice.
I have some in prison.
Yes. I'm surprised that they didn't try to put Nye in prison, but he was a very popular man. He was a former he was a United States senator until 1944, I think. So it was difficult to indict a United States senator in the sedition trials, which for the most part took place in 1944. There were three sedition trials, and this is something what we should definitely cover in this series, because while the Jews and the communists had taken over the Roosevelt administration, had taken over the country, and were getting ready to divvy the world up for Judaism at Yalta, any serious opposition, and there wasn't much, but any serious opposition to the Roosevelt administration's policies was more or less stifled when a group of patriotic Americans, a lot of them America Firsters, a lot of them members of the America First Committee, were actually indicted for the first time in July of 1942. And there were three sedition trials. They had never convicted anybody, but when and I noticed personally, when you are indicted by the federal government, and whether you're guilty or not doesn't matter. If you decide to fight your case, there is nothing else you can think of or do or expend your energy on except defending yourself in your case. And the federal government, they know this damn well. Federal prosecutors know that when they indict you, they have you in prison that very moment, because now your prison, even though you're not in Leavenworth yet, your prison, it is finding out the cause of your indictment, what evidence the government has. They don't reveal to you what evidence that they have until practically right before the trial. And you're tied up with defense lawyers and preparing a defense, and all your energy goes into paying for that or preparing that, and you can't do anything else. So they basically stifled all opposition by tying up several dozen people in these sedition indictments, people that were patriotic Americans and good, hardworking Americans, and they tied them up, and they're tying up these several dozen people in these sedition indictments in 1942, scared off who knows how many hundreds of people that would have been intelligent voices of opposition to the policies of the Roosevelt administration.
They see what happened to the leadership, and they basically run because they don't want to go down.
Absolutely. And the government, any president can do this anytime he wants. All he needs is one prosecutor on his side politically, and he could do this anytime he wants and tie up all his opposition. And amongst the defendants in the sedition trial were people like Elizabeth Dilling. Elizabeth Dilling, of course, wrote that book, the Unmasking the Talmud. Well, she also wrote a book in 1940 she had published called The Octopus, the Octopus basically proved in 1940 how America was already controlled by a Jewish Zionist Jewish minority. So they had her on a list, right? Then there was Lawrence Dennis was another one. Lawrence Dennis wrote a book. He had published a book in 1936 called The Coming American Fascism. Now I think that Lawrence Dennis is abusing the term fascism, but fascism is seen as another it's seen by the Jews and by mainstream Christian academics as another totalitarian government model that absconds people's property, and it's that's why the agencies, the draconian agencies we have in this tyrannical government today, are seen as fascist, and that's based on a misunderstanding of fascism. But that's what Lawrence Dennis wrote, The Coming American Fascism, and he was trying in it to explain the nature of capitalism and how it produces tyranny. That there's no doubt. Now, another book Lawrence Dennis wrote was The Dynamics of War and Revolution, and he was trying to expose the evil forces within capitalism, which fascism, real fascism, the fascism of Mosley and Hitler and Mussolini, that their fascism was a response to the evils of Jewish capitalism.
If I'm not mistaken, too, they went after Gerald L.K. Smith at the time, didn't they? He was one of the defendants in the trial.
I'm not sure if Gerald L.K. Smith was actually a defendant. I mean, it's a pretty long list. I'd have to check it out. I have one article here that ran in the Bond Review in December 1999. It's a good article on the Great Sedition Trial. It was written by, I'm not wild about Michael Collins Piper, at all the time, but he's one of the authors of the article, him and Ken Hoop. And I read this article years ago, and it was I thought it was a very good article. There's a list of descendant of defendants here on that there were actually three stages of indictments. I don't see Gerald L. K. Smith's name amongst the list of defendants.
Oh, he was.
And
in
I don't
the later
know
trials.
When. Excuse me.
He was in one of the later trials in 44.
Okay, I don't see his name in the list, but I don't know when he went to Congress either. I know it was in the 50s. I don't know if it was that early. I don't see his name in the list. It's definitely something that we should discuss before the series ends.
All right.
Because the sedition trial, while the purpose of this series is to expose the treason in the United States government, and the Jewish treachery in the United States government, it's the sedition trial was a huge part of that because they silenced for 3 years during the Second World War. They silenced all of their opposition, and it was simply political opposition. These people weren't committing crimes. That right wingers to a Jew, just being a right winger, you're evil, and they'll want to start. We don't understand the mind of the Jew.
Well, all Christians are fascists.
Well, absolutely. All Christians are evil Nazi fascists, and that's very evident. There's half a dozen videos on my Christigenia website with Jews that consider Christians to be evil Nazis and fascists simply for the fact that they're Christian. And this isn't Christian identity people they're talking about. That this isn't Christian separatists they're talking about. These are mainstream evangelical, we love everybody, Jesus loves everybody Christians.
You mean the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons?
Right, exactly. And if they're evil Nazis and fascists, well, what does that make us? well, yes, it's the Gerald Nye, I think, was the beginning of exposing of Jewish treachery in high places in this country. But it didn't receive enough press. It was seen as red baiting then. And at that time in the 1930s, that's incredible. But that's the power of the media. That's absolutely the power of the media. The Jews control the media. These events do not unravel by accident. This doesn't happen by accident. This is all orchestrated, whether it be in the back rooms of banks or in synagogues. It is not a mistake that one Jew stubs his toe and 100,000 Jews across the country are screaming about it. It's not a mistake. And sure. All of this, the accusations of red baiting and the downplay of the influences of communism in government circles in Washington in the 30s and 40s, that downplay by the media was all purposeful. It was the Jews running cover for each other because they were making off with the country.
So they
and by extension with the world.
When really you're not trying to bait the Reds into any kind of argument or do anything like that. You're just looking to expose them and discredit them and destroy them.
Well, Gerald Nye was one of the first big Washington senatorial committees to try to expose Jewish perfidy in the United States government. And Alger Hiss was the chief counsel. Imagine that.
I was wondering, too, do you remember this dorky little movie in 1945? Not that you would personally remember it. It had Frank Sinatra in it, and he was arguing against prejudice. It was a real short 10-minute little clip, and some neighborhood boys apparently were arguing amongst themselves, and one of them said that he didn't trust another one because the other one wasn't a Christian. And he said, "What are you, prejudiced? That's stupid. That's stuff for the Nazis. You're not a Nazi, are you?" And the message is quite clear. If you have any religious convictions, you're some kind of Nazi.
Well, absolutely. If you're not all for free love and giving the Jews everything that you have, you're some kind of Nazi. Well, we don't. The fault of Americans, the fault of Christians, is that they don't see the Jews in light of what the scripture says about them, that these people are indeed devils.
So if you object to your daughter being dishonored and your son being turned into a, you know, dope fiend or a sex-crazed maniac, then you're a fascist, you're a Nazi, you're evil, you have to go away.
Well, unless the white man has a good grounding in real Christian doctrine, he has no defense at all against the Jew. The pagans have no defense at all against the Jew. That's just the way it is. Only Christian identity, only identity Christianity has a two seed line identity Christianity and an understanding of the nature of the devil. That's the only viable defense against the Jew. Okay, on to Alger Hiss's work in the Justice Department briefly. Do you want to talk about that or should I start reading? I guess
sure.
I'll start.
Could you remind me again just what page we're on, though? I have so many articles pulled up.
Well, we're on the Conservapedia article, which is an overview of the entire Alger Hiss case.
Okay,
in 1935, Hiss transferred into the Justice Department, and that was from the AAA, or the Agricultural Adjustment Agency.
Which was under
now,
at the time, right? Because people were saying
Hiss transferred. Hiss transferred to the Justice Department as a special assistant to the Solicitor General. I'm sorry, that was from the he was in the AAA and he moved to be the chief counsel for Gerald Nye's subcommittee, and from there he transferred to the Justice Department. I apologize. Where he was a special assistant to the Solicitor General, where he unsuccessfully defended the Agricultural Adjustment Act before the United States Supreme Court, which ruled the act unconstitutional in 1936. I went into the details probably too much last week over what the act consisted of, but today, what with the Supreme Courts that we've had ever since the Roosevelt administration, today the federal government is basically doing far more than the Agricultural Adjustment Act ever called for with its control of farming. It's incredible. The Supreme Court of 1935 would be that they'd all be, even the liberals might be rolling in their graves today. This is 1929 Ford. Yeah, you know, this here right here is a good example of evidence in the Hiss trial, which had come out that the liberals and the Jews, the closet Jews, the crypto Jews, whatever they are all of the communist bastards and their sympathizers today. This is a perfectly good example of evidence that they ignore. I've seen about 40 websites in my research when I researched all of this last week, which were defending Alger Hiss and still claiming his innocence. And with the McCarthy hearing transcripts and all the other little pieces of evidence that surrounding this Hiss case, and some of it involved in directly in his case, it's absolutely incredible to me that they would be insisting on Alger Hiss's innocence. However, once you see the big picture, you'll see that they basically have to still insist that Alger Hiss is innocent, because so many liberals and people that were viewed as mainstream people in the 40s and 1950s and since then were defending Alger Hiss, and they would all be basically exposed as communists. I mean, this is how they trick us, that they argue with us over these little details incessantly. They leave out that most Americans do not understand the evidence in cases like this. They won't take the time to understand it. They read Time magazine, which is edited by guys like Whitaker Chambers that are communists in the first place, that they're getting a washed out version of the story, and that's intermingled with pro-communist propaganda, and they can't make a sound decision based on that. So we end up in endless bickering, and in the meantime, the wolves are devouring the entire sheepfold. It's on and on and on. Well, this is a perfect example of the evidence that the Alger Hiss defenders ignore. This is 1929 Ford. In the summer of 1936, Jay Peters arranged a dummy transaction, according to Chambers, in which Hiss donated his 1929 Ford to the Communist Party. Now, in 1936, Hiss was working as a solicitor for the U.S. Justice Department, right? Hiss would deny this, testifying instead that he had sold or given or loaned, depending on when he was asked, the car to Whitaker Chambers in June 1935 after buying a new car. But Hiss did not buy a new car until some 3 months after he sold the old one, and he continued to pay insurance on the Ford for a year after he claimed to have gotten rid of it. Chambers' version of the story would be corroborated by the car certificate of title, which showed that Hiss actually transferred the car on July 23, 1936, to the Cherner Motor Company, which sold it the same day to the known communist William Rosen for $25. The company's records of the transaction had vanished. Rosen would refuse to answer questions about his role in the transfer or about the Communist Party on grounds of potential self-incrimination. Hiss's attorney, Edward McLean, wrote that Rosen's lawyer, Emanuel Block, had told him, quote, that Rosen did lend himself to a dummy transaction concerning the Ford car. At some later date, a man came to see Rosen and told him that the title certificate to the Ford was in Rosen's name and asked Rosen to sign an assignment of it to some other person. Rosen did this. The man who came to see Rosen was a very high communist. His name would be a sensation in this case. The man who ultimately got the car is also a communist. Block implied that Rosen was a communist too, but did not say so expressly. The title transfer bore a signature Hiss acknowledged to be his own, notarized by Hiss's Justice Department colleague W. Marvin Smith. In 1948, Smith would tell the Thomas Committee that he had notarized Hiss's signature on a transfer. But before he could do so, testifying in a Hiss trial, Smith would be found dead from a fall down a five-story Justice Department stairwell. There would be no witness. Imagine that.
Interesting coincidence.
I imagine that can't possibly be a coincidence.
So he must have been awfully clumsy for a spy.
Well, absolutely. And it's funny that the communists were using this scam with donating a car or selling it for a fraction of its value. And basically it turns out to be a donation, right? And isn't that what it's the same scheme they do today constantly, that they try to get people to donate old cars and then they inflate the value so that people could write off a much higher value on their taxes. Isn't that a Jew charity scam today? I think it is. Okay. Next chapter in this paper on Alger Hiss, head amassing in Noel Field, more external evidence. At a 1935 dinner at the home of State Department official and Soviet intelligence source, Noel Field, Hiss argued with OGPU recruiter Hedda Massing that Field should work with Hiss's GRU group rather than Massing's OGPU group, according to Massing. Now the OGPU, that's the Russian version of the CIA, isn't it?
And it came after the Cheka. I believe it was a successor group to the Cheka, the State Political Directorate.
Field would defect in 1948 to communist Czechoslovakia, where he would tell the secret police that he was fleeing to avoid testifying in the trial of Alger Hiss, whom he identified as a fellow communist underground agent in the State Department during the mid-30s, according to official records published in 1990 by Karel Kaplan, another Jew, former archivist of the Central Committee of the Czech Communist Party. Now this man had no, I can't see what the motive could have been for him to say these things about Alger Hiss many years later while in communist Czechoslovakia and not being able to return to the United States. A 1955 Czechoslovak secret police reinvestigation obtained in 2000 by Czech human rights activist Karol Skrabek states, quote, Noel Field said that Hiss worked for the USSR as a spy. Field would end up in communist Hungary, where in 1954 he would tell Hungarian secret police that he and Hiss mutually realized we were communists. Around that sounds like an epiphany, right? Around the summer of 1935, Alger Hiss tried to induce me to do service for the Soviets. The transcripts also record Field saying that he turned over State Department documents to Hedda Massing in the 1930s. In other statements, Field twice said that although Hiss knew that Field, quote unquote, was a communist, he strongly supported Field at the State Department and even tried to help him obtain a job as State Department advisor in the Philippines in 1940. The dossier likewise records a statement by Field that he briefly visited Hiss in 1939 in America, where they agreed that if either's cover was ever blown, he would communicate to the other indirectly. Shortly before his death in 2001, Field's brother Herman said the dossier was accurate. Noel Field confirmed it to him, said his brother, that Hiss was a spy. In a 1936 memorandum found in the NKVD archives by former KGB agent Alexander Vasilyev, Massing complains to Moscow that Field, whom she refers to by his code name Ernst, was approached by Alger Hiss, Massing uses Hiss's real name, who informed him that he is a communist with ties to an organization working for the Soviet Union, a serious breach of discipline. A Moscow Center annotation identifies A. Hiss as the GRU agent designated by the codename Jurist. As a result, noted Boris Bazarov, OGPU, illegal station chief for the United States, and Hiss, Bazarov also used Hiss's real name, have been openly identified as Field and Hiss have been openly identified as Soviet agents. According to Massing, Hiss also asked Field to use his connections to help Hiss get into the State Department, which he obviously did not have a problem doing. That now it's well known also from and I read some of the testimony from the Mein Kampf, from the McCarthy hearings last week. This Nathaniel Wheel, who was a State Department lawyer, a State Department economist, he also separately testified in the McCarthy hearings that Alger Hiss was a known communist all the way back to the days of the AAA, and Hiss evidently had no problem getting into the State Department. Alger Hiss took a pay cut to transfer into the State Department, which he did from the Senate Committee. In September 1936, in the same month a GRU agent designated by the codename Jurist began working there. So we see corroboration of that in Russian, in the Russian OGPU records, right?
So if he actually maybe his handlers increased his stipend.
Right. Well, this is what Glasnost did for us in the 1990s, was it opened up access to Russian and for other historians also to all these Russian state archives, these Soviet state archives, right? Hiss was now special assistant to Assistant Secretary of State for Trade Agreements, Francis B. Sayer, son-in-law of Woodrow Wilson. Just wonderful. It's like parasites infesting the entire cadaver. 2 years later, Alger's younger brother, Donald, who had followed him to Johns Hopkins, Harvard Law, and a clerkship for Justice Holmes, meaning Oliver Wendell Holmes, would join him at the State Department, rising to the position of assistant to future Secretary of State Dean Acheson. in a cable of the era found in the NKVD archives. Now the NKVD, is that the forerunner? That's the successor to the OGPU and the forerunner to the KJV, right?
Yeah,
KGB, I mean, I'm sorry.
KGB,
the KGB, I'm sorry.
And then the MVD, of course, came after that, too. But the Cheka and the OGPU were the predecessor groups. And it's hard to keep track of all these groups. There's so many. There's the GRU, the SVR, the MVD, the KGB, the Cheka. It just seems that it's literally a phone book's worth of secret police agencies in Russia.
In a cable of the era found in the NKVD archives by Vasilyev, NKVD illegal Ishak Abdulovich Akhmarov, he does not sound Russian, reports to Moscow that J. Peters, codename Stormed, told him that Hiss, Akhmarov used his real name in the communication, used to be a member of the Brodsky Organization, the Communist Party USA underground, who had been implanted into Surrogate, which was a cover name for the State Department, and sent to the Neighbors, which was a code name for the GRU. The year before, at the funeral of Marshal Joseph Pilsudski in Warsaw, Poland, U.S. Ambassador to Moscow William C. Bullitt had given confidential assurance to the Polish government that the United States would stand by Poland in the event of a Nazi invasion. Right. But after Bullitt reported back to Washington that he had done so, someone at the State Department passed this information to the Kremlin, which in turn transmitted it to German intelligence, with which Soviet intelligence had maintained liaison since the time of Lenin. Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels exploited this information to portray the United States as a warmonger. According to De Toledano, meaning Ralph De Toledano, the State Department source who passed this information to the Soviets was Alger Hiss.
Oh,
at
and
some
about
point,
guy, Bill, you mentioned Ishak Akhmarov. He was actually born in the Soviet Union. He was a Tatar.
He may have been a Tatar. It's just an awfully Jewish-sounding name. Abdulovich, Ishak Abdulov. I guess he could be an Arab, an Arab, right?
They said his wife was Helen Lowry, Soviet name Elza Akhmarova, the niece of CPUSA General Secretary Earl Browder. He himself, Ishak Akhmarov, whatever, he was in the KGB. And while in the U.S., he worked closely with a man named Joseph Katz.
Well, none of them sound too American. At some point in 1935 to 1937, Chambers gave Hiss a rug from Bokhara in Soviet Uzbekistan. Just before Christmas, 1936, Soviet Colonel Boris Baikov, head of Soviet military intelligence in the U.S., had given Chambers $800 to buy four Bokhara rugs for Hiss, Harry Dexter White, George Silverman, and Julian Wadley. According to Chambers, Hiss would later claim that Chambers had given him his rug in 1935 in partial payment for rent. Chambers' version was corroborated by Marxist, here's another good American, by Marxist Columbia University art historian Meyer Shapiro, who confirmed that he arranged the purchase and produced the canceled check dated December 23, 1936, by the Massachusetts Importing Company of Manhattan, which confirmed selling him the rugs and produced the bill of sale, by White's widow and Silverman, who confirmed that they had received their rugs sometime between late 1936 and the fall of 1938, and by Wadley, who confessed to having been a member of Chambers' apparatus and delivering documents to him, confirmed that he had received his rug for New Year's 1937 and conceded that he understood the rug to be a gift from the Soviets. So the whole Washington, D.C. Establishment is just crawling with these commie traitor bastards, right?
And with a name like Meyer Shapiro, you don't know whether he's a communist or a psychiatrist or both. That he was a Columbia University art historian. I wonder if that consisted of bashing classical art and praising whatever they would call modern art.
Well, I try not to think of names like Pablo Picasso, but sometimes they just stick in your head, right? He's a straight clown, and his paintings are going for about 10 billion Jewish shekels a piece, right? By 1937, the peak of Stalin's Great Terror, whose victims would number over 10 million, Hiss was delivering packets of documents to Whitaker Chambers at intervals of a week or 10 days. According to Oleg Gordievsky, the highest-ranking KGB officer ever to defect. That year, Akhmarov cabled Moscow that Michael Strait, codenamed Nigel, an FDR protege and intimate family friend of the president and first lady, who was also a member of the NKVD's Cambridge spy ring, we should probably cover them someday, and would become an FDR speechwriter and publisher of the New Republic. Imagine that, an FDR with a Cambridge spying communist for a speechwriter. Why am I not surprised? Then working at the State Department, mentioned Hiss, using his real name, as someone with progressive views. And I've long said that progressives, that's just another cover name for communism, right? Who occupied a responsible position. Akhmarov worried that Strait might guess that Hiss belongs to our family or find out Hiss's nature as a GRU agent. On November 23rd, 1937, Whitaker Chambers bought a car using $400 he said that Alger Hiss loaned him. Hiss would deny making the loan, but records show that the Hisses, meaning him and his wife, withdrew $400 in cash from their savings 4 days before Chambers bought the car. That's just a coincidence, I guess. At first, the Hisses claimed that they had used the money to buy furniture for a new house, but they had not signed a lease at the time and could not produce receipts for any purchases, nor explain why they had used cash from savings rather than the checking and charge accounts they otherwise used for such purposes. In 1938, Whitaker Chambers made his final break with the communists. Weary after the murder of Ignace Poretsky and disappearance of Juliet Points, Chambers asked his wife's nephew to hide what he called his quote-unquote life preserver, a packet of copies of documents, handwritten memos, and microfilm. On the advice of Herbert Salo, former press agent for the Communist League of America, Chambers made it known to the Soviet underground via Shapiro and the ex-communist and former Soviet agent Ludwig Lohra that he had photographic copies of handwritten matters, the appearance of which would seriously embarrass them, which would be made public in the event that anything were to happen to him. In 1939, Sayre became United States High Commissioner to the Philippines, and Hiss transferred to become personal aide to Stanley Hornbeck, political advisor to the State Department's Far Eastern Division. When Hiss first walked into the office, Hornbeck advised him that he had been warned that Hiss was, quote-unquote, a Red. Foreign Service Officer Max Waldo Bishop, who worked in the same office, said Hiss occasionally had dubious left-wing characters in his office. Hiss, meanwhile, urged Sayre to hire as his replacement Soviet intelligence source Noel Field, despite his lack of experience. Due to the fact that Field had been identified to the State Department as a member of various Red Front groups starting in 1926, and as a Communist Party member the previous year, he did not get the appointment. Sayre would later refuse to testify as a character witness for Hiss. After his defection behind the Iron Curtain, Field would confirm to East Bloc authorities that Hiss knew he was a communist when he recommended Field as his replacement. So Hiss had a lot of influence. He was collecting it, and we see it would last all the way to Yalta, right? And he was definitely using that to pass secrets to the Soviets, to so that the Soviets could anticipate American strategy and American political demands long before they're made. And that's very valuable. That's also very detrimental to the German cause in Europe, right?
Sure, and as we're getting into right now, if these people were genuine socialists concerned with the workers against fascism, shouldn't they have been outraged and appalled when Stalin signed the non-aggression pact with Hitler?
Well, absolutely, but that there were a couple of cases that we've read over the past few weeks and of people who resigned the Communist Party when that happened.
But there
were a couple of mentions of that in the McCarthy hearing transcripts.
For the most part, though, I think we've established that these people weren't really any kind of ideological communists. They were just Soviet agents, and most of them were opportunists. They were just looking for a way to make money and weaken America. They didn't really value the socialist ideology at all. They were just dupes for the Jew.
Well, we haven't seen it expressed. It can't be... Yeah, you know, Alger Hiss went denying his because for the rest of his life, for 50 years or for 45 years anyway, he denied ever having been a communist. He denied being guilty of perjury. He denied all that. And because he denied it, we'll never really understand his motives for doing it, will we?
Hmm. Whitaker Chambers now, owned up to it, didn't he? He admitted that.
Yes. Whitaker Chambers admitted being a communist. And I think that Whitaker Chambers and probably a lot of fairly young men turned to communism at the height of the Depression, seeing it, realizing that capitalism was evil. And they were naive stooges because they didn't realize that communism was just a tool of the Rothschilds and the capitalist bankers to oppress and Eastern Europe that they otherwise couldn't get their claws on.
So basically the excesses of Jewish capitalism drive justice-minded white people into the arms of the Jewish communists.
Yes, absolutely. And that was their – I don't know if that was their first stop. A lot of them describe themselves as socialists, and that was in response to the excesses of Jewish capitalism.
Populists and progressives.
Well, a lot of them found a way to be communists. There's no doubt. And for whatever the motives, that these men were traitors to their nation. And they were certainly traitors to their race. That they should have realized that all of these top-level Russian communists, that none of them were Russians. How could you not? How do you miss that one? It's hard to define in a few moments exactly what their motives could have been or how much they knew or how much they could have known. It's something that should be studied if we have enough time left in this age to do so, what would be nice. But
Chambers never explicitly spelled out his motives then, did he?
I'm not sure. Chambers did write a pretty voluminous book on the Alger Hiss case. I haven't really checked to see if I haven't followed Chambers through to that point in his life yet.
And Hiss would never even own up to the fact that he was a communist.
Right. Chambers admitted breaking from the Communist Party because of the doctrines and the policies of Stalin and some of the things that happened under Lenin's rule, but I don't know if he's written it, and I haven't read enough of his own writing to find it yet, to find his motives and his feelings after breaking with them.
Well, he was terrified they were going to kill him too, wasn't he, Chambers?
Oh, absolutely. He was sleeping with a gun and everything. He was terrified they were going to kill him. Yes, there's no doubt. Oh, okay, the Nazi-Soviet pact. And a lot of Americans did, a lot of American communists did become disaffected with communism when this pact was signed, but surely not enough. And that it's funny how they became disaffected with Soviet communism because the Soviets entered this relationship with the Nazis, and they thought that those German fascist Nazis were so evil that the communists were soiled for dealing with them and sold themselves out dealing with them. And in absolute reality, it was the other way around.
Oh, and if Chambers had gone to Moscow the year or two before he had the falling out with the communists, as they ordered him to Moscow for, you know, briefings and whatnot, and he just put it off, made excuses, if he had gone, they probably would have killed him, wouldn't they?
Oh, I'm certain, right, that once you there's any chance that you're out, that you're quitting the club, there's no quitting anything like that. You can't just up and leave. You're in for life. You've sold your soul to the devil, there's no doubt.
Your retirement plan is a bullet in the back of the head in a shallow grave in Belarus.
Absolutely. The Nazi-Soviet Pact. When in the wake of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, the Communist Party organ, the Daily Worker, came under suspicion for reversing its anti-Nazi posturing, Politburo member Roy Hudson discussed what to do about it with the Soviet agent Robert Miner. According to former Daily Worker editor Louis Boudens, someone mentioned that Nathan Witt and Lee Pressman, and there's a name that we know from the Agricultural Adjustment Act, right, could not be of much help as they too were under suspicion at the time. According to Boudens, Alger Hiss was then mentioned as a good comrade who would be helpful. That year, French Premier Edouard Daladier informed Bullitt, now ambassador to France, that two brothers named Hiss, both in the U.S. government, were Soviet agents. Bullitt, quote, laughed it off as a tall tale, never having heard their names, unquote. The year before in Paris, defecting former GRU chief in Europe, Walter Krivitsky had identified Hiss as an agent of Soviet military intelligence. According to Alexander Barmine, former chargé d'affaires at the Soviet embassy in Athens, who had defected in 1937, when news of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which Krivitsky had predicted, broke on August 24, 1939, Krivitsky warned his Saturday Evening Post ghostwriter, the Russian emigre, here's another one, Isaac Don Levine, and that doesn't sound too Russian to me, everything that went on in the embassy, especially the major communications between Washington and William C. Bullitt, were quickly relayed to the Soviet secret police. So with the Depression, the Jews were able to manufacture many, many traitors to help out the cause of the Soviets, right? That's what it seems to me. It really helped them in more ways than just oppressing Christian Europe and Christian America.
So if I were a suspicious conspiratorial inclined person, I might think that they caused the Depression so they could blame the Depression on the excesses of free enterprise, when really we didn't have free enterprise at the time because we'd had a Federal Reserve for the last 15 years. And then they blamed everything on free enterprise and traditional American values, and they offered up the pill of socialism, telling people that if you don't swallow this socialist pill, the country won't get any better. And that's what they're doing again today, isn't it? They're blaming the recent, you know, housing bubble, the credit crisis, whatever you want to call it, the recession, the depression. They're blaming it on free enterprise, and we haven't had free enterprise for 80 years.
Right. We haven't had free enterprise since 1913. No doubt. Whitaker Chambers meeting with Burl. In 1938, Whitaker Chambers confessed to Levine that he had been a courier for the Communist Underground. As the joint Nazi-Soviet invasion of Poland was gearing up, Levine sought to get Chambers an appointment with President Roosevelt, but was diverted by the White House to Assistant Secretary of State for Administration in charge of security, Adolf Burl. That's a coincidence, right? His name is Adolf. On September 2nd, 1939, Chambers told Burl of an underground apparatus of the Communist Party for employees of the federal government in Washington, D.C. Its organizers, said Chambers, was Harold Ware. And we see that he was the man who recruited Alger Hiss and all those other communists in the Agricultural Adjustment Act, right? Its treasurer was Henry Collins. Among its members, he identified Lee Pressman, Nathan Witt, and the brothers Alger and Donald Hiss. While Chambers talked, Burl took notes. Under the heading Underground Espionage Agent, he listed several names, including Alger Hiss, with the notation Assistant to Sayer, CP 1937, Communist Party 1937, and member of the Underground Com-Active, Communist Party active member, I guess that's Burl's notes. In Burl's diary, the entry for September 4th, 1939 reads, quote, Isaac Don Levine and his contact with the Krivitsky matter had opened up another idea of the Russian espionage. He brought a Mr. X around to my house on Saturday evening. Through a long evening, I slowly manipulated Mr. X to a point where he had told some of the ramifications hereabout, and it becomes necessary to take a few simple measures. I expect more of this kind of thing. Later, a good deal of the Russian espionage was carried on by Jews. We now know that they are exchanging information with Berlin, and the Jewish units are furious to find out they are, in substance, working for the Gestapo. Before the month was out, the Nazi and Soviet armies staged a joint victory parade through the streets of occupied Brest-Litovsk in Poland. In 1952, Burl wrote, I have vague recollections of having mentioned the matter to the president when shortly thereafter we were working on the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA. That should have included every Jew in the country, right? Which was the real tangible outcome of this. Burl's vague recollections of this matter were in fact mistaken. FARA was actually enacted in 1938. The year before he met with Chambers. In his 1973 memoir, Levine wrote that he later asked Burl how FDR responded, quote, to the best of my recollection, the president dismissed the matter rather brusquely with an expletive remark on this order, oh, forget it, Adolf. In 1940, after Levine informed Bullitt of what Chambers had told him about Hiss, Bullitt relayed to Hornbeck what Daladia said had told him. I'm sorry. Bullitt relayed to Hornbeck what Daladia, the Frenchman, the Charge d'Affaires, had told him the year before. Bullitt advised Alice Roosevelt Longworth and Ralph de Toledano that he also took in this information directly to FDR. Levine also told David Dubinsky, president of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, about Chambers' revelations. Dubinsky wrote Levine that, quote, took up the Chambers matter with the president at the first opportunity and was brushed off with an amiable slap on the back. Well, Franklin Roosevelt was probably the head of the communists in Washington, right? I mean, that's what I would think. Levine wrote that he also told fellow journalist Walter Winchell, there's another Jew, of a ring of six Soviet agents operating within the State Department alone.
And certainly and Winchell probably knew about it. He was probably coordinating that spy ring.
And his broadcast of December 12th, Winchell announced that he had carried my information to President Roosevelt. Still, there was no action. Four and a half years later, Hiss is at Yalta with Roosevelt, right? Well, Winchell's posthumously published memoir confirms Levine's story.
I'm sure Roosevelt knew about every Soviet spy ring in the country. He helped them get into place, and he approved it.
Diplomat Sproul Braden, said he knew of three separate occasions when the question of Hiss was raised before Roosevelt, including, apparently, once by liberal columnist Darcy Thompson. Each time they were completely ignored. For Hiss, was a family friend of the Roosevelts. FDR, therefore, merely scoffed at the charge. According to British historian and former diplomat David Stafford, as a result, no counterintelligence program for identifying communist agents in the federal government was put in place. Now, how is it that this agency lawyer is how he started out, right, for a small agency in Washington, an agency that only lasts for 2 years, and he becomes a family, and he happens to be a card-carrying communist, and he becomes a family friend of the Roosevelts, and so close to him that he's beyond any reproach, that there are three clear accusations that he's a card-carrying communist and a Soviet spy, and they're all just ignored. That can't be just, no president should just take that lightly, right? I mean, that's a serious accusation, especially if it's of one of your friends. Well, the only way you're going to just brush that off is if you know he's a communist and you like it that way.
You know, Roosevelt knew, but he didn't care because he was one himself.
Well, right. He was a Soviet agent, too. or at least he reported to the same master that Stalin did.
If you tell Roosevelt, so-and-so's a Soviet agent, I used to be one. I know, I used to work with him. And Roosevelt says, well, if you want to rejoin the team, I'll get you a job in the State Department. Otherwise, jump in the lake.
Well, there's no doubt. We lost the United States government in 1913. That there is no doubt. We have never had it since. It's all been just a show. We're a communist nation now in everything but name. We've been a communist nation in everything but name since Franklin Roosevelt. In consequence, Hiss would rise unimpeded through the ranks, in 1944 becoming Deputy Director of the State Department's Office of Special Political Affairs, a policymaking office for post-war planning and international organization. In August, he would organize the Dumbarton Oaks Conference, where he would serve as Executive Secretary, presiding over the drafting of the proposed United Nations Charter. Burl, in contrast, I mean, the Soviets could never have it so good to have their agents just rise right to the top, no problem, that they're exposed all over the place and they still just rise right to the top. Burl, in contrast, found his State Department career soon over. Shouldn't have said anything, right? By 1948, he would be serving as chairman of New York's Liberal Party, working for the reelection of President Harry Truman. That year, the New York Bureau of the Christian Science Monitor would send a teletype to the Home Office in Boston relating a background interview with the party's publicity director, Arnold Belchman, or I'm sorry, Beichman. Quote, from a thoroughly reliable contact, according to this informant, Burl has said privately the classified material which Hiss was handling was reaching the Russians. It was coded stuff. Burl took the handling out of Hiss's hands and the leaks stopped. That's probably why he was fired. But in the wake of Dumbarton Oaks, Burl had been ousted as Assistant Secretary of State in charge of security, defeated by the State Department's pro-Soviet faction, Hiss being prominent among them. As Burl put it, quote, in the fall of 1944, there was a difference of opinion in the State Department. This is much greater than a difference of opinion, right? I felt that the Russians were not going to be sympathetic and cooperative. Intelligence reports, which were in my charge, indicated a very aggressive policy, not at all in line with the kind of cooperation everyone was hoping for. I was pressing for a pretty clean-cut showdown then when our position was strongest, just like Patton wanted. The opposite group in the State Department was largely Mr. Acheson's group, Dean Acheson, with Mr. Hiss as his principal assistant in the matter. At that time, Mr. Hiss did take what we would call today the pro-Russian point of view. I got trimmed in that fight and, as a result, went to Brazil, and that ended my diplomatic career. All of those pro-Soviets in 1944, that just get a list of them, and you'll find the whole list of communist spies and Soviet espionage agents and traitors to the country. The House Committee on Un-American Activities. By 1940, Alger Hiss was among a handful of the Soviet's most important agents who were run individually and not through spy networks. According to Oleg Gordievsky, Hiss's wartime controller, wrote Gordievsky, was Akhmarov, the leading NKVD illegal in the United States, who, in a lecture before a KGB audience, identified Hiss as a Soviet agent during World War II. In 1941, Hiss came to the attention of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. HUAC had grown out of a 1934 resolution calling for the formation of a special committee to probe into un-American activities, introduced by Congressman Samuel Dickstein, Democrat, New York, a Soviet agent codenamed Crook, who, under the pretext of investigating U.S. fascists, was secretly paid by Moscow more than $12,000 during the Great Depression, which was equivalent to $180,000 when this article was written, to persecute American businessmen, Soviet refugees, and Trotskyites. During the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, HUAC, H-U-A-C, that I'm probably mispronouncing that, now under Chairman Martin Dees, Democrat, Texas, included in its probes communists as well. In the midst of the pack, the Dees Committee obtained the membership list of the Washington Committee for Democratic Action, which would be confirmed as a communist front the following year by Roosevelt's Attorney General Francis Biddle. I'm surprised she didn't get fired, or he didn't get fired. Included on the roster was the name of Priscilla Hiss, with the notation appended, husband with State Department. So that was known 5 years before Yalta, right? Federal Bureau of Investigation, as mandated by the Hatch Act, this HUAC finding triggered an FBI background investigation of Hiss, in the course of which one of Hiss's former colleagues at the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act Agency, told investigators that Hiss and his circle were fellow travelers, if not communists. Hiss denied everything, although he said he thought his wife might have been a member of the League of Women Shoppers, a popular front group. That just sounds like a ridiculous slap in the face. Identified by the committee in 1939 as a communist front. I'm sorry?
So much for feminism.
Right, the League of Women Shoppers. In 1942, the Bureau sent a report of this investigation to the Secretary of State, the first of what would become a veritable avalanche of FBI memos and reports on Hiss disseminated to the State Department, Attorney General, and White House over the ensuing 5 years. From 39 to 44, right? After ex-OGPU agent Ludwig Lohre identified Chambers to the FBI as a former Soviet agent, the Bureau interviewed Chambers for the first time in 1942. Chambers repeated his identification of Hiss, among others, as a communist. In 1943, the FBI obtained the notes Burl had taken during his meeting 4 years earlier with Chambers and Levine. That year, an encrypted cable, decrypted in the Venona Project and released in 1995 from the Controller of Military Intelligence for the NKVD, codenamed Moliere, who was undercover as Soviet Vice Consul in New York, Pavel B. Mikhailov, to the NKVD Chief of Foreign Intelligence, Lieutenant General Pavel Fitin, codenamed Victor, in Moscow, identifying the real names and codenames of several agents in the U.S., said the GRU, codenamed Neighbors, reported someone from the State Department by the name of Hiss. So the evidence that Hiss is a communist spy, a Soviet spy, is just astounding. I mean, it's all over the place. It's all over government records. It's all over the Soviet records. And the left wing, I mean, I have at least half a dozen articles in a folder on my desktop, some of them from the New York Times, some of them from several other various other websites, that all insist that Alger Hiss is innocent. It's incredible.
George Soros, I believe, has financed several websites to prove that Alger Hiss was wrongfully accused.
AmericanHeritage.com, that's the one. I almost said American Renaissance by mistake. It's AmericanHeritage.com. That website must be a left-wing front. It must be a communist front. Alger Hiss convicted, but was he really guilty? It's 56 years ago today, Alger Hiss was convicted of two counts of perjury and sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. This is from AmericanHeritage.com, right? A graduate of Johns Hopkins University and Harvard Law School, protege of Felix Frankfurter, Jew, one-time law clerk to Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, should have been a Jew, former State Department official and head of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, right there, I know you're a communist. Hiss was among the best and brightest of his generation. His fall from grace was an early landmark in an altogether frightening period in American politics. Yeah, when you point out the wolves in the sheepfold, for the Jews, that's a frightening period in American politics, all right?
Oh, and American Heritage, it's full of people who are Guggenheim Fellows, Pulitzer Prize winners, and they're coming out of Columbia and Harvard.
Yeah, right. They're all communists. This is definitely a... this website is definitely a communist front.
It was founded
no
in 1947, American Heritage Magazine.
Well, I have several articles from the New York Times on my hard drive, which also defend Alger Hiss to this day. These are recent articles which are still trying to exonerate this man.
And it was founded in Rockville, Maryland, in the D.C. metro area, probably by Soviet embassy officials.
Well, I believe that all of these... The left is running cover for itself to this day, and because of all the bickering and petty crap over and leaving out facts and not citing all of the evidence or not collecting it into one place, and most people being totally uneducated about it, it just causes clouds in the minds of the American public. The communist voice is the prevailing voice in the Jewish media by far, I'd say probably 99-1, and most of the public getting its education from the Jewish media. That's why we could never stop them in this country. It's not possible. You can't outspend the people that print the money. It's not possible. We lost this nation in 1913. It was all downhill from there. Okay, we should probably stop here, and this is a good place to break and pick it up next week with this Len Lease Act, right?
Here's a little clip from an American Heritage article. The only people who object to communism and who use it as a bugaboo are the Nazi agents in this country. I am not a communist, but I am proud to say that I feel pretty pro-communist. They were quoting somebody in 1942. And then some editor went on to comment about how they refused to be pushed into falling in line with the hate the communists, hate the communists, hate the communists, because there's no communist conspiracy.
And they were all communists.
And they talk about Nazi agents in the USA in 1942. What, all four of them?
Right.
Well, if we want to talk about the communist agents in the U.S., we could just take a phone book from New York City and take another phone book from D.C. and say, here you go.
Well, this American Heritage article that I'm looking at, I mean, they spend two paragraphs contrasting Alger Hiss's dapper appearance with Whitaker Chambers' overweight, sloppy appearance, and as if that would that would decide whether or not Hiss is innocent or guilty, right?
So Hiss's handlers were able to afford a better suit for him, and Chambers, who'd been on the run and was fearful for his life, couldn't afford to dressed like a mafia don.
Right, exactly.
And they think that that should influence our opinion of either of those two men.
Well, this Alger Hiss, he seems to have had a tremendous influence in the Roosevelt administration, and he's only one. He's only one Soviet agent, and there were many Soviet agents in the Roosevelt administration. And they weren't only telling the Soviets what was going on. I mean, that was a big part of it, but the bigger part is that they had a voice in the setting of government policy.
And a lot of them, they were taking their marching orders from the Soviets. I'm sure before Rosenfeld did anything, he got up on the red phone here and called Uncle Joe in Moscow and said, "Hey, Uncle Joe, what should I do?"
Yeah, you know, these are the men that wrote the Lend-Lease Act and other legislation along the same lines.
Speaking of that Lend-Lease.
These are the men in concert with the Jewish media that are the reason why we were so closely aligned with the Soviets and there was no outspoken criticism of it that had any enduring effect on the minds of the people.
If I loan you my truck and I loan you my rifle, isn't it heavily implied that you're eventually going to return them?
Yeah, right. Lend-Lease Act.
So, I mean, when are we getting our stuff back? Obama won't.
We got it all back. We got it all back in caskets.
Obama won't even let M1 Garands and M1 Carbines come back into this country from South Korea because he said the weapons could wind up being used to fuel the drug war on the streets. I can't imagine a drug dealer running down the street with a 9-pound M1 Garand, can you?
Well, we might get to that point. Well, we might get to that point in this country. Philadelphia is awfully close. There's a few towns that are awfully close.
Just more communist rhetoric from Obama, though. He sees no problem with sending billions and billions in weapons to Israel, but he won't let collector's weapons come back into this country so American enthusiasts can obtain them. All right, then. So I guess we will pick up next week with part 3 of Alger Hiss.
Yes, we will. Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.
We'll win in the end.
Right, bye.